Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in. Well,
so good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's really wonderful to be here with you today and to be at Greenbelt. Deep gratitude to Amos Trust for the partnership that they have had with Holland Trust for many, many years. And I also want to give a deep appreciation to Greenbelt, a festival that has kept the issue of Palestine alive as a continuous discussion and justice for the Palestinian people. So deep gratitude for Greenbelt for all these years. And I really hope one day this will not be an issue at Greenbelt, that I could actually come here and enjoy the festival like many of you do as well. So today's topic is a big one, beyond the two states, what is next? We're going to try to engage in this. I don't have any notes, so I will share my thoughts with you as if we're having a conversation. The problem is I have the mic and you don't for now, so I will be doing this one-sided conversation with you. But I hope at one point it will trigger different questions and comments that might come from you. And I do want to start by saying you mentioned the word wise and wisdom. And I think if I had the right wisdom, again, we would probably not be in this conflict. But it is just sharing my views and my opinions as to what is happening there and maybe where there is a possibility for a future in peace. And I do say maybe. As hopeful as I am as a person, I also look at the reality. And the reality is one where it is getting more and more difficult, more and more challenging for the Palestinian community. Many of you have been there. Many of you have come over many, many years and have seen and witnessed the deterioration of the situation for the Palestinian community and the entrenching of the occupation as a structure for us. Physical, mental, emotional, systemic violence that we face on a continuous basis. So to begin to talk about the future, I think it's very important to talk about the past. We cannot just jump to talk about what is a future vision. It is very important to understand where we come from. Why are we living in this conflict, this occupation, this injustice? What are the real core reasons behind it? What is this conflict really about? What is the situation really about? As I mentioned yesterday, many people, including myself, for the longest time, believed that this is just a political conflict between two political entities, two nations that are fighting over the same piece of land. And somehow we need to find some solution to it. Divide it up between them, cut it up, give one section one part, give another one part. This is the idea of the two-state solution. Make it very simple, very easy. Just like in a divorce, you take this and you take this and we settle it and we write the agreement. But I think it became more aware for me in my consciousness that there is much more complexity to this conflict than just seeing it as a political conflict between two nation states. And so for me, I want to review a little bit of the history. I mentioned some of it yesterday, but to bring this clarity of why we live in this conflict. And for me, it is important as part of this to address some of the myths that are connected with this conflict that many of you have experienced, heard, or maybe even learned as growing up, especially in the Christian community. One of the myths that is very much connected to this conflict is the myth of the longevity, how long this conflict has existed. And the idea that many people talk about is that this is a historic conflict that has existed for millennium, for many, many, many years, thousands of years, these two peoples have been fighting with each other. And they link it to a religious understanding that pretty much says this conflict cannot be resolved in our world, in our understanding today, that it is a theological conflict That means it has to be addressed through a theological framework, the second coming of Christ. And everything has to lead to this second coming of Christ for this conflict to be resolved, or Armageddon, whatever theologies people have. And for me, this is something that I want to dispute, because if we want to talk about the future, we cannot talk about a future of two peoples that have hated each other since the beginning of time. How can they have a future together if they've never lived in peace at all? And this is why it becomes very important to remember also the parts of history where the nations that lived in the Holy Land, in what was known as historic Palestine even, did live in peace with each other. So we cannot talk about the future without remembering also the good old days where Jews, Christians, and Muslims actually lived as good neighbors with each other. One of the symbols of this life is actually the kufiya that I wear. Many people look at this now and say, oh, this is a political symbol of the PLO and Yasser Arafat and the resistance movement and the freedom fighters. And I wear it now not to in any way bring out the political meaning of this, but actually to bring out the cultural indigenous meaning of this. To tell you, many of you may not know, that Jews, Christians, and Muslims actually used to wear this at one point. It wasn't just the Arabs or the Palestinians that wore the kufiya. And actually the symbols of the kufiya are indigenous symbols to connect to land and water. This symbol is the fishing net. This symbol, every mark on this is a leaf from an olive tree. How many of you knew this? I did not know this until a few years ago as well. And most Palestinians don't know this. So when we talk about indigenous rights to the land, we talk about land and water, the fruits of the land, the olive and the olive tree, and the fruit that comes from the sea, the fish, and the food that we eat from the sea. This was something that Jews, Christians, and Muslims celebrated in the land, and of course other tribes and other religions that existed there. And so for me, I wear this to remember those days where we all lived together in peace and equality, even in a sense, with each other. The turning point did happen. A turning point did happen that changed the reality of life in the Holy Land. And the turning point, as far as I see it, actually had nothing to do with the land itself or the peoples of the land. It was the challenges that were happening in Europe, mainly from Russia to Spain, for the Jewish community that lived here. We are a victims of anti-Semitism. And I say this as the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims who live in the Holy Land. The anti-Semitism that grew up thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, against the Jewish community that mainly was manifested in Europe, and the high point being the Holocaust itself. This for me is very important to talk about because, again, if that situation did not happen, I always ask myself, what would life be like today in the Holy Land? If discrimination and racism against the Jewish community did not take place in Europe, what would Palestine look like today? Let us not forget that a major movement of bringing the Jews from Europe into Palestine came as a result of the discrimination that the Jewish people were facing here, that made them open up to the question, how can we maintain our survival in the midst of all of this racism against us? And the only way to do that is by us establishing our own independent state that is secure from such discrimination and anti-Semitism. And the Palestinian community became the victim of the victims. This is the reality of what happened in the land. This is the reality of why I think we live in this conflict today. So again, not just as politics, but a movement of a nation, of a people that was facing so much racism and discrimination, the high point being the Holocaust itself, where the notion of never again came out. Never again, for many in the Holocaust, should this happen to anybody, but for many, never again should this happen to us as a people. The mindset of the strong Jewish presence became the turning point instead of the poor Jew who was always the victim and the receiver of discrimination. It's very important to look at this point because when we talk about the future, one of the things that is very important to address in the past is the trauma of the peoples that lived in the land. The Jewish community that was experiencing discrimination and racism, and the Palestinian community that suffered from 1948, the Nakba, where the only way the Jewish community was able to create the notion of maintaining a majority Jewish nation is by doing what? Getting rid of those who were not Jew. And I know it might sound very simple, but this is, again, when you are motivated by fear and trauma, you would engage in actions that you would not if you were not traumatized by these experiences. The Jewish community in the Holy Land lived in peace with the Christians and the Muslims there. Yesterday I mentioned about an Israeli Jew who came to me in a lecture one day in the United States. He's living in the United States and actually interrupted me to show the crowd his birth certificate that says, born in Palestine. As a Jew, I was born in Palestine and I'm a proud Palestinian. Part of what the Zionist agenda did was to eliminate Judaism from Palestinianism. This is very important. We, even today, do not remember the Palestinian Jewish community. We do not celebrate the history of the Jews in Palestine. And for me, it becomes very important to bring those memories back. If we want to talk about a future that is not built in the framework of fear, we need to honor that being Palestinian doesn't mean being Christian or a Muslim. This is the reality we have now because Zionism pulled the Jews out of the Palestinian identity itself. And I think part of what we need to do together is to celebrate that history that we had together. Thank you. The notion of having a Jewish nation, a majority Jewish nation, fed by an ideology called Zionism, fed by maintaining a majority control over the land, fed by also making sure that as much of the land is available to them, led to the situation that we have now. So again, I want to make it clear, it is not a political issue as much as this motivation of the Jewish community. How can we maintain a majority Jewish nation, a Zionist agenda, which is about protecting ourselves from having this ever happen to us again, and also claiming to be a democracy? The only way to do that, again, is by eliminating and marginalizing the communities that are not of your own identity. And I think this is where the notion of the two-state solution became key. The two-state solution is not a Palestinian initiative. The Palestinian leadership was actually forced into accepting the two-state solution because it was presented as a take it or leave it. You have no other option except the two-state solution. And the only framework was presented was in the Green Line, the occupied territories, the 1967 borders, resolutions in the United Nations, 242 and 338, that declared these occupied territories as disputed territories and therefore became the framework for the Palestinians to establish their state on it. And I tell you, honestly, as Palestinians who lived in the 80s, we were not happy. We were not happy with the notion of we will have a minimal state called Palestine on 20% of the land, but we did not have a choice. It was the only option presented to us. And I want to say, in addition to this, that for the Jewish community, they also were presented with this solution, and not many were happy as well. Because many of the Jewish community believed, historically, religiously, that this land is theirs, and they have the right to live wherever they want in it. Thus, the settlement movement, the settlers who lived in the occupied territories, the 1967 territories, where many Jews actually believe, and I would say rightfully so, that the West Bank, known to them as Judea and Samaria, is the hub, the breadbasket of Judaism itself. So how can we give up part of this territory that actually belongs to us, and maybe even more spiritually important to us than cities like Tel Aviv and Haifa and Netanya and Eilat themselves? But this conflict and this dynamic was presented again by the international community as the only possible solution, and therefore we were asked to endorse it and to move on with it. And I would say as Palestinians, we were indoctrinated into accepting this. We were programmed into believing, and I was one who fought very, very hard for the two-state solution. I believed in it because I was told this is the only way that I can live in freedom as a Palestinian, by giving up my historic right to the entire land, which means all of the territories of 1948, accepting the West Bank Gaza as the Palestinian state, and we were told we will live happily ever after. This is what Oslo presented us. As we all know, Oslo failed, and the two-state solution has failed. And again, I want to go back into a short part of history to understand why this failure happened. Why did Oslo fail? The first reason I mentioned is this idea that we all believe that the land belongs to us. The Palestinian community, especially the refugee community, have a right to return to their homelands and the right to claim to achieve this goal. We cannot deny this. How it's implemented, if it's implemented, in what way justice is received by the refugees is open for discussion. But we cannot deny the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. And this is something that is very key for us. This is the trauma point for us as Palestinians. The Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. And we will never forget the Nakba and what happened to us. Even in the compromise that we were ready to offer, this issue still remained as a deep pain point for us as the Palestinians. And on the Jewish side, again, as I said before, there is a religious experience for the Jewish community in the whole land that for many Jews, they actually say, after 2,000 years, we have returned and we will never leave this land. I'm going to share a story of a person who is a settler, a Jewish settler who I know. He told me once, listen, Sammy, your nonviolent stuff, it's fine. But I want you to know I don't believe in it. I have guns in my home. And these guns are not meant for you, the Palestinians. They're meant for the Israeli army if they ever come to take me out of this settlement, of my home, of my neighborhood. So when we talk about the settlements issue, we have to understand again, this is not just colonialists who are living in a foreign property and they believe that or we could find a way to get them out of it. And this is again why I think the two-state solution failed and we need to readdress it. A second important point of why I think the peace process failed in Oslo was a negation of a very important voice that as a Palestinian I am proud of. And that is the voice of the Palestinian women, and I would also say the voice of the Israeli women in the negotiations themselves. For us as Palestinians, when we talk about the Palestinian woman, the Palestinian female, the Palestinian mother, it is a symbol of our manifestation in the land, our connection to the land, our farming communities, our carers, is the Palestinian woman. Up until the Oslo peace process, women were known fully as leaders, working with men in the resistance movement itself. With the beginning of the Oslo peace process, that voice was completely marginalized. We became a very structured patriarchal system that completely dismissed the voice of the women. And I believe one of the failures of Oslo is it was two masculine energies fighting over the feminine, the land, and each one claiming that she belongs to him. And only him. And I think part of the challenge that we have is to address this issue of how can we engage in a peace process that is all inclusive. We have all heard stories of when Palestinian mothers and Israeli mothers meet with each other. And the stories they come up with, the visions they come up with, the healing work that happens in that energy when it comes together. That energy was completely missed and negated during the Oslo peace process. The third challenge for why the Oslo peace process failed, I mentioned it before, but I'll mention it again more specifically, is that both camps who were negotiating peace, who were engaged in peace process, who even won Nobel Prize because of their negotiating peace, were motivated by a deep fear, mistrust, and a lack of respect for the other. How can you negotiate peace with somebody who you hate and you are afraid of? fear became the motivation for many of us in how we negotiated peace. And I believe that any negotiation that is motivated by fear is a negotiation that fails. And if it is achieved an agreement, it will not last. We have seen this happen all over the world. We have seen movements to end the discrimination against the African-American community in the United States through the civil rights movement. The law changed, but the fear of the white remained as the motivation and even how to negotiate with the blacks. In South Africa, we have the same experience. We talk about apartheid ending in South Africa. How many of you have been recently to South Africa? Has apartheid ended? No. You have a political agreement that is motivated by fear that does not achieve real justice for the community, and therefore these agreements ultimately fail. The Israeli Jewish community was not negotiating out of a sense of understanding the needs of the Palestinians, out of a sense of we have committed atrocities against you, out of a sense that it is time for us to stand and apologize for what we did to you. The Israeli negotiators were purely negotiating from that notion of how can we maintain a majority Jewish Zionist nation in this land, and having to deal with the Palestinians, the only way to deal with them is to give them a little piece of land and they could have their state. And they called themselves peace negotiators, the voices of peace. Yes, an agreement would have been signed, but the notion, if I'm still afraid of those people, then I will make sure to maintain whatever mechanism of controlling them, of securing them, of making sure that even if they get a state, that state will never in any way be seen as having a potential challenge to us. And therefore, we will maintain control over the Palestinian state. And so this is why I think another reason the two states failed is that if we had reached an agreement, I think now that this agreement would have not have lasted. Israel would have maintained overall security and determination of the discourse of this Palestinian political state, in a sense, just like what they do now as we still live under occupation. So the occupation would have reshaped itself differently. They may have recognized even the state of Palestine, but they would have still maintained control because we, as the Israelis, are motivated by fear. And the Palestinian leadership was also motivated by fear, the existential threat to us as Palestinians, that we will lose any opportunity to be recognized as a peoples in the world if, first, we don't engage in the negotiations, and second, we don't accept the two-state solution, because what became very important for us is land. If we don't have land, then how can we have a state? So when Yasser Arafat was promised Gaza and Jericho first, we celebrated. Finally, we began to liberate some of the land. This is very important for us. But, and then we were given Area A, and I will not get into the area A, B, and C, but only 15% of the occupied territory is under Palestinian control. The Oslo peace process was supposed to give us the 15%, then the 25%, then maybe the 100%. But we got stuck on the 15%. The Palestinian Authority was created. Now they have self-autonomy, self-rule. Let us not give them more land. They have enough. They have power. They have money. They have political prestige. They have their VIP passes wherever they want to go. This is the Palestinian leadership. So they can maintain their own people. And all the negotiations between the Palestinian and Israeli power structures were only in the realm of security. This is what it was all about. And so being motivated by fear, the historic rights of the land, the negation of key voices were the reason why the Oslo peace process failed. For us to talk about the future, it is very important to learn from the past, but again, not to be motivated by the past. How can we make decisions where the communities that live in the Holy Land really begin to learn to recognize and honor the right of the other to live in dignity and respect and freedom and security? I think this is the movement that we are moving towards. To end, because you think now it's the big ending, what happens after this, right? I actually said yesterday, I do not have a political solution to the conflict. I wish I did. I wish I can come up with one and say, this is what should happen. Many of you know that there are actually 23 different proposals out there. Not just the one state or the two state, 23 different solutions that have been presented. There was a Norwegian author who came with a very thick book he wrote called The Seven State Solution. And he was trying to sell it to Palestinians and Israelis. You know, he was sitting in his office in Norway, I think it was, or Denmark, and he came up with this notion, like, again, a white European male coming to tell us what the right solution is and trying to convince us of this. For me, the question, and this is my encouragement to you, is to ask the foundation. What is the foundation that we need to establish a real, just peace in the Holy Land? And one story that comes to my mind from the Bible, the parable of the wise man and the foolish man, talking about back to closing the circle with wisdom. We all know that story. It is the last parable in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus ended with the parable of the wise man and the foolish man. Both of them wanted to build a home. I want to say rebuild because we do that all the time with Amos. To build a home. And the foolish man, what did he build it on? The sand, right? And the wise man built it on the rock. I would say that for us to continue to negotiate the two-state solution as a possibility for the future is foolish of us. It is like the foolish man who continues to build his house on the sand and the slightest wind blows it away. The slightest act of violence by one side or the other blows that notion away. And so for us, we have to begin to look into what is that foundation. The foundation for me is the deep process of healing that needs to take place, where Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, Christians, and Muslims begin to honor and recognize and heal the wounds that we have created to each other, to admit when we have committed acts of violence to each other, to seek repentance, to seek forgiveness, to build a foundation where justice for all the people of this land, equality for all the people of this land is recognized and manifested. This is the foundation that we need. And then we could say, what is the framework of the house that we need to build on it? Many people ask me, is the two-state solution dead? I say, maybe it is dead, and maybe it is not. But I would actually challenge those people and say, until we all acknowledge and recognize the one-state solution, we could never achieve the two-state solution. I'll say that again. Many people say for us to move to one state, we need to do the two states first and then create cooperation between them so we could move into the one state. I would say the opposite. If we want to believe that there should be two states, not because of fear, not because of insecurity, but because we want to honor two distinct, beautiful cultures that live in this land, then we need to have the consciousness of the one state solution. That one state means civil rights, equal rights, human rights for all the people in the land. And therefore, then we could create the different frameworks that can come out of it. That could be from a one state to a 100 state solution then. It doesn't matter to me. So my request to you is as we continue to struggle for the rights of the Palestinians in the land, in the Holy Land, that we begin to create this consciousness of using the words justice for all, using the words equal rights for all, using the words dignity for all the people that live there. We cannot deny that there is an oppressor and an oppressed, an occupied and an occupier. This is the reality we live in. And we continue to struggle through nonviolence to address the daily injustice that the Palestinians face. But the vision that we have has to be an all-inclusive vision for all the people in the land itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Sammy. I'll just give you a moment to digest all that. What we're going to do, we've got ages left, half an hour, so what we'd like to do is to really open this out to a discussion. When I take groups to Palestine, one of the first things I always say is that there's no such thing as a stupid question, because one of the intimidations to being involved in this issue is that there's this concept that it's really complicated. And often I think it's people put smoke screens around it to make it complicated so that people don't engage with it. So please, if you want to ask what area A, B, and C is, or if you want to go over some of the history with Sami, Sami's here. Sami's own lived experience is as a refugee family. Your family used to be in Jerusalem before 1948 and had to move out then. So please, there's some microphones, I think, around. Put your hand up and wait for the microphone to get to you. And perhaps we'll take two at a time, and then Sami will answer them, and then we'll take the next one. So, go.
Hi, Sami. Thank you very much for that. I've heard Jeff Halper speak on a couple of occasions about work that he and a group of people are doing on what a one-state solution might look like. I presume that would come in as the framework that you just referred to. So can you say a bit about how that fits into what you've been saying? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And we'll take a second one and then we'll come back to Sami.
Thank you very much for a very rich talk. I had the privilege of being in Palestine a couple of years ago with Christian Aid, actually, and amazing there. But the question really is just on one word you used, and I'm aware that language sometimes shifts and moves. And one person who spoke to us was someone who said, I am a Zionist, because a good Zionist would say we should be living here together as equals, as Christians, as Palestinians. The impression I got, it may have been wrong, but the Zionism was bad at the beginning of your talk. And I wondered whether the Zionism itself was a shift, because I'm aware in Britain we have to be so careful of the language we use. It's so easy to suddenly be branded because we've used the wrong language. So the word of Zionism.
Yeah. Okay.
So we've got picking up. I don't know if you've heard what Jeff Halper said about the one-state solution. So just unpick that bit and then unpack the word Zionism. Simple.
And we have more time for more questions. Well, I'll be very short with the first answer. Jeff Halper is the founder of an Israeli organization called the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition. Has been an activist for many, many years. At one point, like many of us, he was an advocate for the two-state solution, promoting it, and he did this by supporting Palestinians who have had their homes demolished by engaging in rebuilding these homes and inviting internationals to come and join, and many Israelis who joined this as well. And recently, over the years, Jeff also has opened up to a vision where he began to see that, again, the two-state solution is dead, and we need to begin to think of different frameworks, different understandings. And his framework, and I haven't read too much in the details of it, but it is a one-state solution that recognizes the two nations as two nations living in that one state. And so this is a big part of the work that Jeff is doing. I have invited Jeff, and he will probably come when I go back to give a talk about this vision to people in Bethlehem. The challenge that I have, it's not a challenge with the solution. Again, I mean, we could all dream of the best solutions. And what Jeff presents, I think, is a very doable, workable solution. The challenge we have now is that most people are completely blind in seeing any solution happen, actually. Most Palestinians will reject this, even though he works with Palestinians who came up together with this idea. But for many people, it is seen as a discussion that is happening amongst the activist community or the intellectual community or the academician community, and the reality on the ground is different. It is not accepting this notion. And so for us, again, we have to go back to the foundation. What is the foundation that is needed? Resistance to the occupation needs to continue. And when I say occupation, now we have to even change the framework of how we define occupation, because many people connect occupation with land, connect occupation with 67. That means we have to resist the Israeli military presence in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem so that we would establish the state. Now I speak in a way where I go from a big O occupation to a small O occupation. The occupation I talk about now is the racism and discrimination against the Palestinian community in the whole land itself. This is the occupation that I suffer from now. I suffer from my inability to move around freely. I suffer from my inability to have equal access to the resources in this land, like water being a big issue. I suffer from the inability to be able to send my girls, my daughters, to the university of their choice when they grow up. I suffer from discrimination and racism. And I know this is very challenging to many people who hear this, but this is what the Palestinian community suffers from now. So resisting the occupation, in a sense, to move from, you know, the two biggest schools of nonviolence in the last century were known as the Gandhian school, which is Mahatma Gandhi, and the Kingian school, Martin Luther King. Mahatma Gandhi was about nonviolence as a liberation movement. For many, many years, Palestinians engaged in nonviolence as a liberation movement to liberate the land from the colonialists, in a sense, the West Bank from the Israeli colonialists who came and took it over. Now I think the shift is beginning to move to a different approach, which is a Kingian or Mendelian nonviolence, which is the demand for civil equal rights in the land. South Africa was about one person, one vote. When the Africans in South Africa were actually offered by the government the recognition of the Bantustans as independent nation states, they said no. Like, imagine, this is the notion. Like, Israel coming to the Palestinians and saying, we want to give you the West Bank and Gaza as an independent state, and we will be the first to go to the United Nations and recognize this. The Africans said no. South Africa is for all its people. And we will struggle till we come up with a system where everybody lives in security and freedom. So for me, I look at South Africa as a model. And the same in the United States. So this is where I think for us the struggle is happening. So we need to keep the visions of where we want to go, but understand that our struggle is ending the injustice against the Palestinians and building a foundation, a healed foundation for both of us to build a future vision together on. When it comes to Zionism, it's a very, very big question. And I know the challenges that you are facing in the UK and many, many parts of the world when you begin to challenge Zionism or Israel as being labeled anti-Semitic. I sometimes present it in the model of like a ball of strings, and very, very much entangled with each other. They have been entangled and tied up together so much that when you pull on one, you put stress on the others. So if you become a critical of Zionism and criticize Zionism as an ideology, all of a sudden you are seen as criticizing Israel and criticizing Judaism. If you pull the string of Israel and stress on it and criticize Israel, immediately you are putting stress and being labeled as anti-Semitic, criticizing Judaism and criticizing Zionism and so on. For me, it is very important to also have the clarity. Zionism is an ideology. And for many Israelis, it was a good ideology because it maintained their cohesion as a nation group that was divided, separated, discriminated against for many, many years. It brought them together. And I could see that happening. I don't negate that. And it brought the notion that we need to maintain ourselves and build our own nation states. Fine, everything is fine. The problem is in the aftermath of this. Where are we now? Where are we now? And where we are now is that the Palestinian community had to pay the heaviest price in this movement. So Zionism is a movement that was good for the Jewish people, 100%, and 100% bad for the Palestinian people. And for me, it is not about liberal Zionism or conservative Zionism. When you have a group of people that believes out of fear that the only way that we can maintain ourselves is by maintaining us, that creates a sense of exclusivity. And in that sense of exclusivity, to the best of them, and I know many Zionist peace activists, and I work with them. It's not I boycott them and deny them. But in that sense, that motivated by fear becomes the motivation to make peace with me, I put this as a challenge. And I say, I don't want you to be motivated by fear when you talk to me. And I say this to my Israeli leftist friends all the time. The biggest motivation for many, many Israeli peace activists is fear of me as a Palestinian. The second biggest motivation for many Israeli peace activists is guilt and shame. I don't want any of this to be the motivation. For many Palestinians, peace activists, the biggest motivation for us is resentment of the other. We hate you. But we only know the best way that we can survive is if we make peace with you. I don't want this to be our motivation. So this is where this consciousness shift has to happen. I want to celebrate Judaism in the land much more than I want to celebrate Zionism in the land. And this is what I ask my Jewish friends to do.
So loads more hands. Just we'll take another couple of questions.
Okay. Hello. Sami, you spoke about the Palestinians being victims of anti-Semitism, European anti-Semitism, which for me made a very strong point about what's been happening to Palestine. And I'd like to come back to this question of this right, the God-given right that many Jews, particularly European Jews, that many Jews seem to have, that God, it's written in the Bible, God gave this land to the Jews. And that very strong belief that many people in Israel have and many Jews outside of Israel have. And I've been reading Radha, the Palestinian academic Radha Kami and others, which has been, so there's been some research done into the genetic makeup of European Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, and comparing it to the genetic makeup of Jews who were in the Middle East, and finding that there isn't a match at all. And the claim that Ashkenazi European Jews have a right to be in the Middle East seems to be very questionable, very debatable. So can you say something about how can you, because it sounded like you were supporting Zionism or saying, yes, we can live with Zionists, but when you are faced with people who have this extreme religious belief that they have a right over everyone else's rights to a land, how can you possibly negotiate with that?
Thank you.
Can we take a second one? So, just while Sami thinks about responding to that.
Thanks very much. A kind of maybe stupid question, so thanks for inviting stupid questions. I often hear about the right of return. What, if you can sum up quickly as you do so, clearly what does the right of return mean and what are the implications of that? Because I think it's big and I want to know more. Thank you.
Thank you. A very non-stupid question. Very hard question. Thank you. So, to the first question, for me, in all honesty, I cannot deny anybody's right to identify themselves the way they want to identify themselves. If we want to talk about colonialist systems that have taken over lands and have lived in lands and don't have the right to be in those lands, then all the Europeans need to leave every single country where there are white people and come back here and live in this land. We have a reality. I will never ask an Israeli, because they have no ethnic connection, especially ones that have now been there for generations, to say you have no right to be there, you have to return to wherever you came from. It's like asking the South Africans to do the same, the New Zealand people, and you name it. So for me, it is about acknowledging this reality that we live in, and to say these are people now who live in this land, and we need to find peace amongst each other. When it comes to specifically to Judaism, I actually love to engage in this conversation. Because for me, when the Jews claim that they have the right to be there, it is very important for us to theologically look at this and say, what does this mean? Is it just a right to return, if this is the right, the way they claim it, and to create fortresses and empires in this land? Or is there a calling for the Jewish people that is deeply entrenched in the belief system of what it means to be a Jew in this land? And as we know from the Bible, when the Jewish community did not fulfill its part of the covenant with God when it comes to living in this land, what happened to them? Exiled. How many times were they exiled? Who knows their theology well?
Too many.
Okay. Yeah. Three times. Exactly. Three times. And so for me, when I sit with these very religious Jewish leaders, I challenge them. I ask them the question, what does it mean to be a Jew? What is the covenant of you being a Jew in this land. And there are several important points that are part of the covenant that the Jewish people are actually required to fulfill. If religion is the motivation, then they have to fulfill that part of the covenant, or else, according to the theology, they will be kicked out from this land. The first, a light to all nations. Imagine the beauty of you being a nation that is a light to all nations. And what is the closest nation to you as Jews than the Palestinians? And you have been absolute darkness to us for all of these decades. How can you be a light to me? The second, to treat the stranger as an equal. You want me to be a stranger in the land? There are different interpretations of that word. Fine. Equality. That means we all live under one law. It is a violation of the Torah, of the Bible, when now in the land we have two laws. One is an occupation law of discrimination against the Palestinians, and one is a semi-democratic law for the Jewish people and the Israeli citizens. This is a violation of religion itself. The third part of the covenant, agents of justice and righteousness. Look at the beautiful. I mean, Judaism is a beautiful religion. This is why it's important for us to remind ourselves of it and remind Jews of it. When, again, racism takes over, when this notion of power takes over, power over others, they forget the core of who they are. And the fourth is the land should not be divided. This is key tenets of Jewish faith. And so for me, again, I don't deny Jewish history in the land. If somebody wants to be a Jew, fine. I mean, yes, there is privilege that is given now to Jewish people from all around the world just by claiming somehow that your mother or grandmother or grandmother is a Jew, you have absolute right to this land. But for me, I connect it to the right of return. If Jews believe that they have the right to Aliyah, which is to return to their ancient historic land, then I, as a Palestinian, demand the same equal right as well. I have the right to return if they have the right to return. This is what we talk about when we say equality. How is it fulfilled? When we talk about the right of return, the biggest threat to the Jewish population when it comes to this issue is demography. Oh, they're going to throw us into the sea. They're going to commit the Holocaust against us just like the Nazis. And I was in Auschwitz, and I shared this yesterday. I was in Auschwitz when I heard Israeli teachers tell 14, 15-year-old Israeli Jewish kids that if the Palestinians have an opportunity, they will do to you what the Nazis did to your ancestors. Imagine being a 14-year-old child. And if you've learned any psychology, it is that age, you know, 13 to 15 years old, when a child begins to understand their collective identity. Until that age, it is their personal identity and their family identity, the nucleus. All of a sudden, they begin to, I'm a Palestinian, I'm Scottish, I'm Catholic, I'm Muslim, I'm part of a collective. And then when that collective identity is presented to you as a trauma, then that shapes who you are for the future. And so for me, it became very important to say, to address this demographic issue, working also with Israelis. And the voice of Israelis is growing, not big, but growing now, that is actually saying that the demographic threat is a hoax. There is no demographic threat. The Palestinian community, and you know enough Palestinians, we will never unite or agree on anything. To say we will agree to do something and harm to the Jewish community. The Palestinian community, the Arab community of the Middle East has always welcomed and lived amongst the Jewish people. There is absolutely no anti-Semitism. You cannot say a Palestinian is anti-Semitic when he or she is struggling for their rights. Our rights do not negate the rights of others to live in this land. And so there is a possibility of return. And there are actually several books that have been written, including some Jewish authors that have written books on how can we build that framework of the right of the Palestinians to return. And to also say that for many, many Palestinians, they will not take on this right and engage in the return. Many of them have established themselves in other countries and other nations, but there has to be a sense of justice. I would say my family. I was in the United States a few weeks ago, and we celebrated my father's 80th birthday. 100 awads came to that celebration. You ask any of them, will they return? No. This is 3 or 4 generations on now. But to acknowledge this is very important for us as Palestinians, to say that, especially by the Israelis, to say we have committed this. Until today, the Israeli establishment denies the Nakba And they have even taken this word out of the school system. They actually, if you're a teacher who talks about this, you could be legally persecuted for engaging in a conversation about what happened to the Palestinians in 1948. We need to acknowledge this as a right. We need to acknowledge this as an atrocity that happened and to begin the process of creating the compensations or reconciliation for the Palestinians.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. Maybe two more questions because the answers are complicated and they take a while to come to fruition. So,
he's got the hard job.
Yeah.
Thank you. Could you say something about the wider issue of other nations involved in this process, particularly about the role of the United States? Because it seems to me that they hold a key and would not be happy if... seem to be very much on the Israeli side.
Okay, we're quite sure. So can you just ask a question? But that's the role of other nations in the peace process, basically.
Especially US, yeah.
Yeah. And the last one, sorry.
It's quite simplistic an approach, but has there been any thought towards the truth and reconciliation way of doing things similar to what they did in South Africa?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. As probably all of us know very well, and the point was made very clearly, that the United States has had a one-sided position when it comes to issues of justice and peace in the Holy Land between Palestinians and Israelis. Even as the sponsors of the peace process itself, they have not and never presented a very clear, nonpartisan role, putting the right and necessary pressures, especially on Israel, to achieve peace. And recently we have seen the current Trump administration even engage in activities that even violate basic standards of U.S. policy for many, many years. The movement of the embassy, the recognition of the Golan Heights, pretty soon the whole issue of the settlements, where the U.S. will probably be the country that will accept settlements to be part of the State of Israel officially under the civil public administration, not the military administration of the Israeli army. And we could talk for hours just on why this is happening. So the U.S. policy is one-sided. I will give you very quickly, and not to undermine this conversation, several of the reasons why this is taking place. The first one is the great military-industrial complex relationship that Israel and the United States have with each other. There are billions of dollars involved in this. And the United States and Israel are both benefiting from the war industry itself and benefiting each other and benefiting by selling their military technologies to other nations. So there's first, the financial issue is very, very big. The second challenge is the notion of Christian Zionism, which we kind of addressed. One of the most powerful movements within the Christian community in the United States, especially within the evangelical community, is known as Christian Zionism. And these are people who have very, very great power. And their power is influential financially and in terms of turnout for voting. These are the people that put Trump in office. And Trump said exactly what these people needed to hear so they would vote for him. That's the only reason he won office, because of this these kinds of people. And the third notion is the powerful financial and political influence of the Israeli lobby itself in the United States. These three combined, many other issues, create the perfect storm for the United States to engage in a one-sided approach to this. For me, I would actually say at one point, the movement of the embassy happened, and on a daily basis, it doesn't affect me as a Palestinian. My life did not get better or worse with the movement of the embassy itself. But for me, it just showed the reality of U.S. policy. Even presidents who didn't move the embassy, they did it because they were afraid of losing favor with maybe some Arab countries, but not necessarily because they did not want to move the embassy. And just Trump did what others were too afraid or too shy to do. So U.S. policy for me is very clear, and we are not influenced by it. Our engagement, our resistance, our call for justice has nothing to do with U.S. policy. So this is my answer. Yes, when it comes to the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, there is conversations that are happening on this. The challenge that we have now is that we are still in the midst of continuous violence. We are still in the midst of continuous injustice. People in Gaza are still under threat continuously. People are dying continuously. So we cannot talk about this as a process until we begin to see the end of the violence and the beginning of the movement. And so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was part of the movement from apartheid to democracy when the decision was made to end apartheid in South Africa. People are talking about it. I know many Israelis are afraid of it, but this is a conversation that we continue to have, and I think it's very important to have it as part of the healing work that will take place in the future. So thank you.
Thanks, Sammy. Just a couple of things. I don't want to have the last word. I'll let Sammy have the last word in a minute. If you want to be more engaged with this issue, do what I did. That's not a big thing. But in 2008, I went and responded to the call that's come from the Palestinian community when they said, come and see. If you want to understand this issue more, if you want to feel the sand of the land flowing through your fingers, if you want to see the places where Jesus walked, I'm not saying that the actual churches are, you know, I'm a bit cynical about all that, but there's something about the land. It's the only place I've been, and I work for Amos Trust, which has a global partners, and I've been privileged to go to many amazing places, meet many amazing people. But the day my feet touched the land of Palestine, my life changed completely. And that's a warning and an encouragement for you.
Exactly.
Come and see. Segues nicely into Amos Trust runs loads of trips to Israel, Palestine. And there's some volunteers around. Most of them have got white T-shirts. They've got bits and pieces. You can stay in touch with us. There's postcards you can fill in. There's a little competition, raffle, something. That if you fill in one of the postcards with your name, we will draw it out. And there's a great Palestinian cookbook from our partner, Arawad, in Ida refugee camp in Bethlehem, which you can win if your thing's pulled out. But do keep in touch with us. There's a A5 leaflet with all our trips for next year on it. If you want to get inside this issue even more, come and see. Come and see. Come and see. And then come back, bring your stories, and let's join this movement, this inspiring movement for change. Sammy, I don't want to have the last word. Just give us a last little nugget of your wisdom. And then anyone wants to come and talk to us after, I'm sure we can stick around for a few minutes if you've got other questions we didn't get to. Sammy Awad, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, for me, I deeply appreciate you coming here and being part of this conversation. And I just want to honor those who have been involved in this for many, many years and not given up on the possibility of peace and justice in the Holy Land. And just to encourage you to keep going. I know some of you have done this for decades now, and there's a new generation I see of young people that are going to carry that flag as well. But to also say that it is absolutely selfish of me if I stand here and say Palestine is the only problem and the only place to engage. When it comes to issues of injustice, we are facing a global epidemic of fear-mongering and hatred and racism and resentment. We cannot deny anti-Semitism. We cannot deny Islamophobia. We cannot deny what's happening in Brazil today. And we all know, the lungs of the earth are burning. And so there is a lot of work for all of us to do. And I believe while we engage locally, including in your own communities, make peace with your communities. Make peace with those who are different than you. Make peace with your families if you are struggling in it, because we need to create a momentum, an energy of peace in the world. And it starts with each one of us doing the right thing in their home, in their community, and for the world. So thank you for coming. And we will see you in Bethlehem, and we will see you here, and we'll see you around the world. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.